I used to always say that you can tell, and this sounds really bad, but you can tell somebody who's a psychologically informed physiotherapist because you like them.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Ignite 2023 Conference Conversations Podcasts, Series 4, brought to you by the Physiotherapy Research Foundation, supporting the promotion and translation of research. Let's get started.
Welcome to a pain podcast. My name's Tim Austin, and I'm the chair of the pain group of the Australian Physio Association. Firstly, all of us here today, we'd like to acknowledge the Turrbal and Yuggera peoples of the Meanjin as the original owners and custodians of the lands on which we are here today recording this. And we pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. I'm joined by three wonderful people. First of all, we have Dr. Anne Daly, who is a specialist pain physiotherapist, one of the first to receive that award. She is a clinician, but she also works as clinical lead in Victoria with TAC and WorkSafe. Professor James McCauley, who works at NEURA, the Centre for Pain Impact, and also Dr. Lester Jones, who works in Singapore at the Singapore Institute of Technology as a senior lecturer. Welcome. Welcome to the three of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Tim.
We've titled this, What is Psychologically Informed Practice? And you each have spoken a lot on this topic, and also as some of you clinicians. So I thought we might start by saying, what is psychologically informed practice? And I didn't mention, James, you are a psychologist.
Yeah.
So why don't we start with you? What is psychologically informed practice?
It's a really, really good question because there's no really clear definition of that. So, I'm not a clinician. So I'm a psychologist, a small p, I'm a researcher. But since I've been working all my professional life, all my research career with physios, and I think psychologically informed practice is the kind of physio that I would send my mum to see. I would feel safe sending my mum to somebody who cared about her and treated her with respect and dignity, and my mum felt very comfortable dealing with her and telling her about her life story and et cetera, and about what's concerning her, et cetera. So I think on a very low level, that is what I would consider to be psychologically informed physiotherapy. I used to always say that you can tell, and this sounds really bad, but you can tell somebody who's a psychologically informed physiotherapist because you like them and you like going to see them. And it turns out that those skills are actually really teachable. So those are psychological skills that can be taught to physios to how to communicate in a way that somebody feels respected and empathic, and that you're empathic, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what I would say psychologically informed physio is.
Some of those soft skills that we used to call those. Lester, you also come from a psychology background and then into physiotherapy. What's psychologically informed practice to you?
So probably take a little bit more of a specific definition for psychologically informed practice. So I like to think of it as the adoption of psychological principles and strategies into a non-psychology discipline. And I think that for me, the important thing is being able to adopt the principles and also adopt the theory, the measurement, the ability to adjust the strategies that comes with the psychology discipline. I think adding those things together, I think, is helpful.
And for you, Anne?
What I would say first is, why are we talking about psychologically informed practice? And to me, it's part of the maturation of our profession and this acceptance that the biopsychosocial context of an individual is really important in terms of determining where you're going to go to with the care you provide to that person. And if you understand the importance of that biopsychosocial context, we need to be as psychologically informed as we are biomedically informed and socially informed. So I think that's where I've come to it from progression through my clinical career. And I understand it to be, for me, mostly using cognitive behavioural principles that I've taken upon myself to learn, but also sought supervision from psychologists to make sure I'm doing it in a way that's really useful and safe.
So we've really got this theme of pain being a biopsychosocial construction of our nervous systems, then we need to be incorporating some of those different skills potentially So if we look at some of those sort of psychosocial variables, from the research, James, what do we see? What variables classically come up as being relevant in people's pain experiences?
Well, I'd say the three main psychological variables, but these are really from the cognitive behavioral kind of, or cognitive aspects, really. They would be catastrophizing, probably fear avoidance, and maybe more recently, self-efficacy. And I heard Lester say this morning that people tend to use self-efficacy a little bit too broadly, and I think that's probably very true. But I would say those are probably the three main constructs. There are others. There are pain beliefs, attitudes, etc. And also, which I haven't really talked a lot about before, but distress as well. But that can often be a reaction to having a long-term pain condition or a pain condition. It also can be a trigger for it as well. But those cognitive constructs, I think, or those cognitive influences, I guess, have been seen in the past at least to be barriers to recovery. So they stop people recovering. And I think that there are interventions then which target those and try to help people to recover better. I'm not sure that's always successful, but that's the intention. And that's why I think we're talking about psychologically informed physiotherapy.
And probably also relevant to really specify that each of those things aren't just risk factors for disability, but also increased pain experience. Very direct correlations, connections between catastrophic thinking and intensity levels.
So I think you're absolutely right. There is a direct correlation between that. Whether or not that's causal is a whole other question. I think that the type of people who catastrophize, the type of people who are fear avoidant, are also the people who have worse pain and worse disability. Whether or not those things cause worse pain and disability is a whole other question. We know the type of people who do badly. We can identify those people, but we don't know what causes those. I think that's a whole different set of techniques and research methods that we need to investigate that. So I know it seemed a little bit fuzzy whenever I said, this is what I think psychologically informed physiotherapy is. It's just be nice to your client. But I did that deliberately, I think, because that is really what I see. I'm not sure that some of these other constructs are as important to change as we think they are. I think that the literature is a little bit incomplete when it comes to that.
And there's also literature around those soft skills that the very nature of the consultation, the nature of the connection between the clinician and the patient makes a difference to outcomes.
Yep.
So Anne, in the clinic, how do you assess for some of these things?
Well, I let the person that's come to see me, which is usually someone who has quite complex pain, I let them tell me their story. And that can take a bit of time, actually, but I learn so much from that story. I stop them and ask questions and check in whether I've got the right understanding of what it is that they're telling me. That's sort of our starting point. And I always check in with them if, by the time we start to get to our physical examination, have I asked them everything that's really important to them to tell me on that day? I also ask them, of course, for their permission before I would do anything involving a physical examination, touching them, you know, anything along those lines. I also use a case formulation model very much related to the work Michael Nicholas has done, but really bring into that what that person brought with them, along with their experience of pain, what came before the pain. And I guess with my experiences in compensable healthcare, a lot of what happened around the time of that person's injury and those ideas around it being such an unjust situation that the person may have done absolutely nothing but is in this situation because of fault of somebody else, or, you know, those types of aspects. So really important to understand what they bring with them, which could be strengths as well, very much related to their strengths.
As you were describing that, I think I felt a little bit like James's mother, and I could be Anne's patient.
I was thinking, so I would send my mum to see Anne any day.
I mean, what you've just so wonderfully described succinctly is the patient at the centre.
Absolutely.
The patient's story is at the centre.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've been doing this work for a long time now. I've never seen two people with the same story. Every single person is different, and we have to acknowledge that and address that in the way that we're working alongside that person.
Lester, a lot of your research work, a lot of what you write on, your involvement with various professional organisations has been around a lot of those aspects where what the patient brings as being unique to them can present significant challenges. We're talking here about trauma and trauma in all of its forms. Could you just share with us, what is trauma in this clinical context that we often read about in trauma-informed care?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Tim. And I think that it's important to recognise we're not talking about tissue trauma here. We're really talking about response of a person's nervous system to overwhelming stress that persists. And the events could be something catastrophic like a natural disaster or a car accident. It could be related to experiences of abuse or acts of war and violent conflict. So I think that the events are quite variable, but again, it's not the magnitude of the event that's important. It's actually how responsive the person's system is to that experience. And so I think that, again, when we're thinking about trauma in terms of this context where we're talking about pain, I think it's relating to how a person's system might be more reactive to triggers that might be associated with sensory or cognitive or emotional aspects of pain.
Can I ask Lester a question, if you don't mind? What do you do about that? Those don't seem to be something you can do anything about, traumas.
Yeah, no, I think that increasingly we're finding that the best way to manage trauma is to offer safe context for recovery. And I guess that's important that we're reducing the threat, but I think it's also important that we're starting to add additional safety into the person's nervous system. So Stephen Porges, who's polyvagal theory creator, he has lots of good little hints around this, and he talks about trying to give as many safety cues to the person's nervous system as possible. So it's not just about reducing threat, it's actually about creating safe contexts, and that includes relational context with the therapist. So therefore, you know, again, we'd send people to Anne.
Thank you, Lester.
James, I can see your research brain going there as you hear that. You've been involved in research around psychological factors in pain for a long time now. In terms of treatment paradigms, you've been involved in exploring modification of lots of different variables, cognitive variables, particularly in education. Mm. Without being too broad, what do we see? What does that research into changing these psychological variables tell us?
Yeah, I guess one of the main paradigms that's driven research and clinical practice in the last 10 years, I guess, is the start back approach. That's that stratification, risk stratification and treatment. The original trial was published by Jonathan Hill in the early 2010s, I think it was, or late 2000 and whatevers, and that made a big splash, and it's driven the research agenda since then. But if you look at the actual results of the trial, they found a very, very small effect on disability, nothing on pain, and that is that people were stratified, so I just remind you about that, people were stratified into high risk, medium or low risk, and the high risk patients were treated by a psychologist. Since then, the study, the RCT, has been replicated, tried to be replicated in several settings around the world. The most recent was a big study called Target in the States. They randomized about 2,500 people with acute low back pain who were assessed as high risk of a poor outcome. And those patients were referred to physiotherapists who'd been trained by psychologists to deliver psychologically informed physiotherapy. And the people who were referred to get that, received that type of treatment versus usual care, standard physiotherapy, weren't any better. There was the same amount of transition to chronic low back pain. There was some problems with the trial in that not everybody who was supposed to receive psychologically informed physiotherapy didn't actually get it. They didn't actually turn up sometimes. So there's some problems with the trial, but they did a whole series of sensitivity analyses. And I think it's pretty good evidence to me that actually trying to address psychological barriers to recovery is really tricky. And I don't think that we've got that nut cracked yet. From a research perspective, that's not taking out from anything someone's doing in clinical practice. But from a research perspective, I don't think we've got that cracked yet. Some of the stuff that we're doing has taken that, I would regard it and argue that it's a bit of a step further by combining that with principles from neuroscience, physiotherapy and psychology, melding that together. And I think we've come up with something which I think looks like it's very promising. But yeah, I think it's, as I said, psychologically informed physiotherapy is something that, from the research perspective, I don't think has been cracked just yet.
And in the compensable space, there's been a few studies that have looked at just outcomes of return to work as a key one. And certainly some of those have specifically identified psychological risk factors and barriers and psychosocial too. What do we see in that space?
I mean, it's a complex area. And so we know from the WISE study that people did particularly well when they were accepting of a psychological involvement early on after their injury. To me, one of the issues was that about 50% of the participants refused to go further because they didn't think that seeing a psychologist in the first weeks after their injury was valid. The thing that concerned me more about that was in a healthcare setting, and I would have thought acceptability would have been highest there. So my interest is that physiotherapists are very well placed in that early post-accident setting to deliver what an injured person would consider to be a valid treatment. When we add in that psychologically informed component to it, then to me, provided that's high quality, we're sort of melding the best of both worlds. We've been doing that at WorkSafe in Victoria, using APA-titled pain physios to work with injured workers who've been identified early in their claim as having a high risk of a poor return to work outcome. And that's been running for a while, and we've recently had that evaluated by ISCA at Monash University, and the outcomes are outstanding. It's not a randomised controlled trial, observational, but it's with real life injured workers and a workforce that we have access to. And what we've found is that the outcomes that are changing, basically every outcome we measured changed substantially. Pain intensity, pain interference in sleep, pain interference in general activity, the PSEC2, and we use the PHQ4 as a screener for depression and anxiety, and that changed significantly as well. And when we also looked at a global rating of change statement from the injured workers, within 6 hours of this intervention, they were saying that they were between better and much better. It's really incredible outcomes from a six-hour intervention that was pretty targeted and worked alongside their usual community-based physiotherapy.
Do you mind, again, if I ask a question? Is that okay? Sorry, because I'm dying to get your knowledge on this, Anne. So the strongest predictor that we've ever found of a poor outcome for someone with acute low back pain is whether or not the injury is compensable, whether or not it's a compensable injury. Stronger than pain intensity, stronger than disability, stronger than any psychological variable. Why is that?
There's a couple of things that I would say here, and that is I'd like us to go back and have another look at some of that research, because there's a lot of research where having a compensable injury is actually an exclusion criteria, which I have to say drives me insane. It really does. And so when we look at work which is specifically with people with compensable injuries, we're not seeing that big a difference to people who don't have a compensable injury. So another piece of research we've done with EPOC, the Electronic Persistent Pain Outcomes Collaboration, we've looked at outcomes from pain management interventions for compensable and non-compensable patients, and the differences in outcomes are nowhere near as big as anybody would be thinking that they are.
Oh, that's so interesting.
It's fabulous. And in the research that we've done with EPOC, we've really examined every bias that we might have related to, oh, if you're taking this much opioid, you won't have a good outcome. Sorry, that didn't actually work out exactly as we thought it would. You know, if you score this high in depression, then you're not going to have a good outcome. It's an interesting piece of research because it's so rich with real person stories. But the important thing is that when we compared the outcomes to those who don't have a compensable injury, there's some difference. You have about 1 in 10 more people fitting into not a spectacular outcome compared to your non-compensable population. I do think the whole thing around perceptions of injustice, and the fact that the compensable systems can be very difficult to navigate as an injured person and perhaps a person with low health literacy. We hear good stories about it all the time, which other people don't, where people have had a great experience of their compensation claim. But of course, there's a lot of times where it doesn't work out very well. So the system itself can be, I think, you know, we've heard traumatizing, definitely bruising for quite a few people who come into it, but not all.
Thank you.
Lester, you've done a lot of, again, your work in socially disadvantaged populations. And you could argue that as a social construct, compensable is really challenging for people. It increases their stress levels, they're confused. How do we go about dealing with some of these things in a clinical setting?
You know, this is where I think one of the things we need to really embrace a bit more as physiotherapists is this social contributors, the social aspects of the biopsychosocial model. I think that we haven't done that very well. I think the three things which, you know, and again, Anne sort of raised one of them, the sense of justice or a sense of injustice or the sense of not belonging or the sense of not having autonomy are three things that are really nicely written about as being influential. And I think that, again, once we start looking for those things in an individual, I think that they're really easy to identify where things can be going wrong. But actually remedying them can be much more difficult. And I think that part of that is that, again, I think the important thing with the biopsychosocial conceptualization is that we're talking about a very interactive, integrated process of these domains. And so it's very hard to sort of just pick one out. Okay, we're going to deal with catastrophizing or we're going to deal with this person's injustice and expect things to fall into place. I think that's often realistic. I mean, I have a mantra that all pain is complex, but sometimes it presents simply. And I think that, again, one of the things is once you sort of are thinking about the biopsychosocial model as this interactive process, it does make it challenging. And sometimes the answers are with the client themselves. I think that for a lot of the complexity, often they're the best people to sort of try and work through their story. But often that needs to be flagged to them that part of the story is important. And I think that's probably the key.
The future of research, you mentioned that the social aspects of pain has not been researched as much. It's quite clear that over the last 100 years, the biomedical aspects have been explored significantly. The last 20 to 30 years, perhaps 40 years, the psychological and the social, which arguably may well have the biggest impact on people's pain and disability, lags behind. So that's probably what I'd like to see happen as future. And what would you like to see researched more in the future?
So I guess, you know, from my background where I really like to see real world examples of things and being able to measure change in that, I'm very interested in outcome measurement and experience measurement. And so to me, if we're talking specifically about psychologically informed practice, I think we need more research where physiotherapists, well-trained physiotherapists, are delivering the intervention, because I was looking at this recently and, you know, we're building up that evidence base, but some of it it's still the evidence of psychologists actually doing the research or doing the intervention. So we need to make sure we're building up our base with physios who are doing the intervention, the researching that.
Such as StressModX from Michelle.
Yeah, absolutely. Sterling. Yes, yeah. It's a perfect example. And there's others. Kim Bunnell's work out of Melbourne has also addressed a lot of these things as well. I hope that we can publish our work using the title Pain Physios. But another thing that's really important to me is that I love that we have specialist pain physios now. I love that we have titled pain physios. I think we're an amazing tribe within the physiotherapy profession. But when I look at the clients of WorkSafe and the TAC, they're seeing the ground roots community-based physios. And so trying to get uplift within that group, who are often inexperienced, rushed, you know, seeing really complex situations all the time, that's one of the areas where I'd like to see if we can help with sort of transferring those skills to that group. And that's a project I'm involved with with the TAC at the moment, where we used a co-design process with about 80 TAC clients telling us what they didn't like about their management within TAC and what they wanted, they felt they wanted more from. And then we also used a group of pain experts, physios, psychologists, GPs, and pain medicine specialists. And we've designed a digital platform that helps the physios to collect outcome measures and to score them and interpret it for them. But not only to do that, to then go, oh, look, this person scored high on this component of the outcome measure. They're only in the first few weeks after their injury. Here's a bit of information, advice, and resources as to what you can do with them. Oh, they've scored really high on anxiety. You might not feel comfortable with that, but here's some sort of lead-in conversations that a psychologist has written for you to try. And then as time goes on at 6 and 12 weeks, that the information, the resources change to actually match the fact that nothing stays still. Things can improve, but some things can deteriorate as well.
Interestingly, the recent low back pain standards gave some suggested starters. Yes. And yeah, it might be arguable whether they're appropriate, but one of the very few ones to actually make some suggestions about what to do about these things.
Yeah, and look, that's what, you know, I've been involved in the whiplash guidelines recently as well. And to me, there's nothing more depressing than reading a guideline that just says, no, not enough evidence. We need those clinical, how do we actually put this into our clinical practice? And so that's what we've worked really hard on in this pilot. So that's live at the moment. We're collecting the data. We're asking the physios, what did you think about the resources and guidance that we gave you? But we're also asking the patients, what did you think about the outcome measures? Did you think that was okay, a physio was asking you that? Was that too much of a burden for you to complete? And hopefully at the end of it, we'll narrow that down, work out what outcome measure was actually the most appropriate for them, and take this wider.
James, your future, like you're leading a research group and have done for many years. What would you like to see researched, or maybe you could share with us some of your plans potentially?
Yeah, I'm going to take that opportunity to do exactly that. Thank you, Tim. Ben Wand is a very close collaborator of mine. He's a physiotherapist. We did our PhDs together in the UK, and he's super clever. And he developed this intervention called graded sensory motor retraining. He hates the name. So if anyone's going to come up with a better name, great. I don't have such a hatred for it, so I'm calling it that. He developed this intervention a few years ago, and we went to the NHMRC and got some money from them to test the intervention in a trial. And the intervention really is pretty straightforward. It's over 12 weeks, and essentially we talk to them and I essentially persuade them that pain is much more complex than what's just going on in their back, that the information that's coming from their back into their brain is processed in a different way so that it's not accurate. And we can show them that by doing tactile tests on the back. We can show them that they're not very good at locating touch on their back, for example, or any sensations on their back. And we can train that. And then things get better over time. We get them to think about rehearsing movements they might find provocative, et cetera, et cetera. It's a graded intervention.
Yeah,
it is. It's got elements of graded exposure in it as well. So we tested that and found that it was effective. It was published in JAMA last year. At the same time, another trial was published in JAMA Psychiatry, Pain Reprocessing Therapy, developed by an American team. And they really concentrated more on, from a psychological perspective, persuading people again or explaining to people that the brain was much more important than they had in their experience of pain than they may have thought in the past. So they again tested that, and again they found very nice effects. Everybody knows about cognitive functional therapy and the trial that was just published, Mark Hancock's trial that was, and Peter Kent's that was just published. Again, they found good effects. Now, there's always problems with all of these trials. They're not, none of them are perfect, but they're suggesting that we're on the cusp of a completely new way of thinking about managing low back pain and a successful way. The interesting thing about each one of these trials from completely separate groups, each one of them found effects at the short term that were sustained over 1 year. And in fact, in pain reprocessing therapy and graded sensory motor retraining, about half the people had no disability at 12 months, none. So I think this is an exceptionally exciting time graded sensory motor retraining, the therapy that I'm most closely associated with, it's not mine. I just did the test of it. It's not mine. That's the one I'm most closely associated with. We want to know what to do next, right? Because what I don't want to do, this was done at Neura, and it was done by a group of physios and exercise physiologists. They were the clinicians, six clinicians. So what we don't want to do is immediately just roll that out and start training people, because this has happened all over physio for many years. So the next step for us is to develop with the NOI group from South Australia some training packages, and then test whether or not we can implement that successfully and that clinicians are happy to take it on and patients have similar effects that we originally found. So that's what I want to do. That's what I am doing. And then taking that approach, applying it to neck pain, applying it to, which we got funding for all this, to phantom limb pain, to complex regional pain syndrome. Yeah, so there's a whole series of studies that we're doing at the moment. And if I could just take 1 second to say, if anyone's interested in doing a PhD on any of these projects, please get in contact with me. Thanks, Tim.
And finally, Lester, what would you like to see?
Well, let me finish with a bit of a global idea. And I think that there's been a lot of research and a lot of research money spent on trying to identify what's the transition from an acute pain to chronic pain story. And I think that we need to sort of stop looking for that and start to engage with what was happening with the person even before their pain started. And I'd really like to see much more research on that front.
Yeah, I'd like to see some research on that clinical encounter of how we communicate with patients. Real research based around what is putting the patient at the centre.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much. That time went way too quickly.
It did.
But we must finish. So thank you again to Lester, to Anne and to James. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast on psychologically informed practice. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
You've been listening to another episode of Conference Conversations, brought to you by the Physiotherapy Research Foundation. Make sure you catch the next episode in the Conference Conversations podcast series. Thanks for listening.